A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants us to map what occupational therapists actually do, because he thinks it might be the most misunderstood profession in healthcare. People hear OT and picture handwriting practice for kids, or stroke rehab, holding a fork again. But the scope is wildly broader. Sensory processing in adults, executive function, mental health, chronic illness, energy management, assistive tech, the whole lifespan. He wants to know how OTs differ from ADH, D coaches, CBT. Therapists, physiotherapists, and why this corner of healthcare is so under-recognized, especially the referral pathways for adults who'd benefit.
Oh, this is a great one. And Daniel's right. OT is genuinely one of those fields where the public understanding and the actual scope barely overlap. I remember, back when I was practicing, I'd refer patients to occupational therapy, and they'd look at me like I just suggested they needed job counseling.
Which, to be fair, the name doesn't help. Occupational therapy sounds like something your H department arranges after a workplace accident.
It really does. The occupation, in occupational therapy, means the activities that occupy your time. Everything from brushing your teeth, to managing your calendar, to tolerating the sound of a fluorescent light. It's not about employment. Although they do workplace ergonomics too, which just adds to the confusion.
By the way, quick housekeeping. Today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V4 Pro, which is writing our script. There, that's out of the way. So Herman, let's start with the fundamentals. What does an OT session actually look like? If I walk into a clinic, what happens?
This varies enormously by setting, but let me give you a concrete example. Say you're an adult with sound sensitivity, misophonia, where certain sounds trigger a fight or flight response, chewing sounds, keyboard clicking, that sort of thing. You walk into an OT's office, and the first thing they're not doing is putting you on a couch and asking about your childhood.
Which is what most people would expect from any kind of therapy.
Instead, they might start with something like the Dunn Sensory Profile, a standardized assessment developed by Winnie Dunn, an OT researcher. It measures your sensory processing patterns across multiple domains, auditory, visual, tactile, vestibular, proprioceptive. It tells you whether you're hypersensitive, hyposensitive, or a sensory seeker in each domain. It's not a conversation, it's a validated instrument with normative data.
They're quantifying something subjective. Most people experience sound sensitivity and just think they're being irritable or difficult.
Right, and that's where the OT approach differs fundamentally from talk therapy. A CBT therapist might work on reframing your thoughts about the triggering sound. An OT says, let's look at your actual nervous system arousal, let's look at your environment, and let's build a sensory diet.
Sensory diet? That's a term I've heard. What does it actually mean in practice?
A sensory diet is a scheduled set of sensory activities designed to keep your nervous system regulated throughout the day. For someone with auditory hypersensitivity, it might include noise-canceling headphones during focused work, scheduled breaks in a quiet space, and something called auditory desensitization. Listening to triggering sounds at very low volume in a controlled, predictable way, gradually increasing tolerance. It's not exposure therapy in the C sense, where you're challenging catastrophic beliefs. It's neurological habituation, working at the level of the autonomic nervous system.
The OT is thinking about the nervous system as something you can regulate through sensory input, not just something you talk your way out of.
And this is where the profession's intellectual lineage matters. OT emerged from the mental hygiene movement in the early 20th century, but it really crystallized during and after World War I, when you had thousands of soldiers returning with what they called shell shock. The insight was that doing things, engaging in meaningful activities, was therapeutic in itself, not just keeping busy, but rebuilding the capacity to participate in life.
That's a helpful framing. The goal isn't symptom reduction in isolation, it's participation. Can you function in the environments that matter to you?
That's the core of it, And the way they operationalize that is through something called activity analysis. An OT will take any activity, making a cup of tea, paying bills online, getting dressed, and break it down into the component skills required: motor planning, sequencing, sustained attention, sensory modulation, emotional regulation, environmental navigation. If there's a breakdown anywhere in that chain, they target that specific link.
Let's get concrete about the conditions. Daniel mentioned a bunch in his prompt: executive function issues, mental health, chronic illness. Walk me through the range.
The breadth surprised me when I started digging into this years ago. So yes, pediatrics is a huge chunk of the profession. Developmental delays, autism, sensory processing disorder, handwriting difficulties. And yes, neurorehabilitation. Stroke, traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, that's the other classic domain. But the adult mental health space is enormous and under-recognized.
What does OT look like for someone with depression or anxiety?
Let's take depression. The symptom that often gets overlooked in standard treatment is the collapse of daily structure. Someone stops showering, stops cooking, stops going out. Medication might lift mood, CBT, might address cognitive distortions, but neither directly rebuilds the behavioral scaffolding of a functional day. An OT might start with something called activity scheduling, but unlike the behavioral activation you'd get in CBT, they're also assessing the sensory and cognitive demands of each activity. Why is showering hard? Is it the executive function demand of initiating the task? Is it the sensory experience of water hitting skin when you're already in a low arousal state? Is it the standing balance required?
That level of granularity is not what I'd expect. I assumed it was more like, here's a checklist, try to do these things.
Most people assume that, and that's why OT gets confused with coaching. But a coach typically works at the level of accountability and strategy. What's your goal? What's blocking you? Let's make a plan. An OT is looking at the underlying performance components. They're trained in anatomy, neuroscience, kinesiology, and sensory integration theory. In the US, you need a master's degree to practice and increasingly a clinical doctorate. This isn't life coaching with a medical veneer.
Where's the line between OT and physiotherapy? Because I think that's another common confusion.
Physiotherapy focuses on movement and physical function, restoring range of motion, building strength, managing pain through exercise, and manual therapy. OT picks up where that leaves off. Now that you can lift your arm, can you use it to brush your teeth? Can you reach into a cupboard? Can you type? The OT is thinking about the activity in context, not just the biomechanics.
Physio treats the body part. OT treats the person doing the thing.
That's a decent shorthand, though it understates the physio scope too. Good physios think functionally as well. But the core distinction is that OT's endpoint is always occupational performance, participation in the activities that give life meaning. That could be self-care, productivity, or leisure. The same shoulder injury, the OT is asking, what does this person actually need to do? A pianist and a construction worker need very different shoulder function, and the OT tailors everything to that.
Let's talk about chronic illness, because Daniel specifically mentioned long COVID and EDS Ehlers, Danlos syndrome, and energy management. That's a domain I wouldn't have associated with OT at all.
This is one of the fastest growing areas in OT practice, and it's almost invisible to the public. The key concept here is pacing, but not the vague, take it easy, advice patients usually get. OTs use something called the Energy Conservation and Work Simplification Framework. They'll do a detailed activity log with the patient, map out energy expenditure across a typical day, and then systematically redesign routines to work within the energy envelope.
Give me an example of what that redesign looks like.
Someone with post-exertional malaise from long COVID, they crash after doing too much. An OT might observe that they're spending significant energy on meal preparation in the evening when their energy is already depleted. The intervention isn't rest more. It's something like batch cook on Sunday morning when energy is highest, use a perching stool in the kitchen to reduce orthostatic stress, reorganize the kitchen so frequently, used items are at waist height to minimize reaching and bending, and build in a 15-minute rest period after cooking before attempting to eat.
That's remarkably specific, and none of that is medical in the traditional sense. It's environmental design and activity sequencing.
And for EDS, where you have joint hypermobility and autonomic dysfunction, the OT might focus on joint protection techniques. how to open a jar without hyperextending your fingers, how to get out of a chair without stressing your shoulders. They might recommend adaptive equipment like jar openers or ergonomic utensils. But the key is that they're not just handing you gadgets. They're teaching you how to analyze your own movement patterns and make adjustments in real time.
It's education, not just accommodation.
The goal is always to build the person's capacity to problem, solve their own occupational challenges. You don't want someone dependent on the therapist forever. You want them to internalize the analytical framework.
Let's pivot to assistive technology, because that's another area Daniel flagged, and I think that's where OT intersects with some of the AI and automation stuff he works on.
This is a fascinating space right now. OTs have always been involved in assistive tech, wheelchairs, communication devices, environmental controls. But the explosion of smart home technology and AI is expanding what's possible. An OT might set up voice-controlled lighting and temperature for someone with limited mobility, or configure a tablet with cognitive support apps for someone with executive function challenges. Things like visual schedule apps that break down morning routines step-by-step with timers and prompts, or apps that use geofencing to deliver reminders when you arrive at the pharmacy.
The OT is essentially designing an external executive function system.
That's exactly what they're doing. And here's where the distinction from AI coaching gets really sharp. A coach might help you develop habits and accountability structures. An OT is assessing your specific cognitive profile, working memory capacity, processing speed, attention regulation, and then matching technology and strategies to that profile. They're trained to understand the neurology underlying the functional deficit, not just the behavioral manifestation.
That raises the question Daniel asked about why this is so under-recognized. If OTs are doing this incredibly sophisticated, individualized work across such a broad range of conditions, why does the public think it's all about handwriting and stroke rehab?
I think there are a few structural reasons. First, OT is historically a female-dominated profession, about 90% women, and there's a well-documented pattern of female-dominated healthcare professions being undervalued and under-recognized relative to their scope.
Nursing has fought that battle for decades.
Second, OT is inherently hard to describe because it's so contextual. A cardiologist treats hearts. That's easy to explain. An OT treats the gap between a person's capacities and their environment's demands, which varies for every single person. There's no elevator pitch that captures it. Third, OTs often work embedded in teams. Hospitals, schools, rehab centers, where their specific contribution gets blurred with everyone else's. In a hospital, the patient sees the doctor, the nurse, the physio, and the OT. The OT's work might look like, they help me practice getting dressed, which doesn't sound medical or specialized. The patient doesn't see the activity analysis, the neurological reasoning, the environmental assessment behind that seemingly simple intervention.
That connects to the referral pathway problem Daniel mentioned. If people don't know what OTs do, they don't ask for referrals, and doctors who don't understand the scope don't think to refer.
This is a genuine systemic failure. Let's take adult sensory processing issues, misophonia, hyperacusis, sensory overload, and autism. Most adults with these issues have no idea that OT can help. They might see an audiologist for the hearing sensitivity, get a normal hearing test, and be told there's nothing wrong. Or they might end up in psychotherapy, which can help with the emotional response, but doesn't address the underlying sensory modulation problem.
A lot of these adults have probably been struggling since childhood without ever getting a name for it.
The sensory processing framework came out of pediatrics. A. Jean Ayres developed sensory integration theory in the 1960s and 70s, working primarily with children with learning disabilities. For decades, the assumption was that sensory processing issues were a childhood thing that kids grew out of. We now know that's not true. Adults have sensory processing differences that significantly impact their quality of life. But the assessment tools and intervention protocols for adults are still catching up.
There's a lifespan gap. If you weren't identified as a child, the system isn't designed to catch you as an adult.
And the referral pathways reflect that. In most healthcare systems, pediatric OT is fairly well established. Schools have OTs. Early intervention programs have OTs. Adult OT outside of physical rehab is much harder to access. If you're an adult with executive function challenges, sensory sensitivities, or energy management issues, you typically have to find an OT yourself and pay privately. Insurance coverage is spotty.
What about mental health, OT, specifically? You mentioned it's an enormous area. How does someone access that?
In some countries, the UK, Australia, Canada, OTs are integrated into community mental health teams. They might work with people with schizophrenia on daily living skills, or with people with bipolar disorder on routine stabilization. In the US, mental health OT is less common in outpatient settings, though you'll find OTs in psychiatric hospitals and residential programs.
How does that differ from what a C therapist does with the same patient?
Let me make this concrete. Take someone with severe anxiety who can't use public transport. Therapist would work on the cognitive distortions and safety behaviors, the catastrophic thoughts about what might happen on the bus, the avoidance patterns. They might do graded exposure, where the person gradually approaches the feared situation while learning that the catastrophe doesn't occur. That's evidence-based and effective for many people.
I'm not knocking C. It's one of the most robustly validated treatments we have.
An OT approaches the same problem differently. They might ask, is there a sensory component to the bus anxiety? The noise, the crowding, the unpredictable movement? For someone with sensory processing sensitivity, that's not an irrational fear, it's a genuine neurological overwhelm. The OT might work on sensory regulation strategies before and during the bus ride. They might analyze the specific route. What time of day is least crowded, where to sit to minimize motion sensitivity, how to use noise-canceling earbuds strategically. And they'd embed all of this in the person's actual life context. What are they trying to get to, and why does it matter?
CBT primarily works on the internal cognitive and behavioral response, while OT works on the person-environment fit.
That's the distinction. And ideally, they complement each other. The best outcomes often come from integrated approaches where CBT addresses the cognitive patterns and OT addresses the functional and sensory foundations. But our healthcare systems aren't great at integration.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about the assessment process, because I think this is where the rigor of OT becomes really apparent. You mentioned the Dunn sensory profile. What other standardized assessments do OTs use?
There are dozens, and they're condition and domain specific. For executive function in adults, there's the Behavioral Assessment of the Dysexecutive Syndrome, the BADS, which uses real-world tasks rather than just paper and pencil tests. For activities of daily living, there's the Assessment of Motor and Process Skills, the AMPS, which is an observational assessment where the OT watches someone perform familiar tasks and rates them on standardized criteria across motor and process domains. AMPS has been calibrated using RASH analysis, a statistical method from item response theory, across more than 100,000 people worldwide. When an OT says someone has a processing deficit affecting their ability to sequence a multi-step task, that's not an opinion, it's a measurement.
That's the kind of thing that should make referral decisions much more straightforward. But I'm guessing most Gs don't know these tools exist.
MDs couldn't name a single OT assessment instrument. And that's not entirely their fault. Medical training covers an enormous amount of ground, and allied health professions get maybe a lecture or two. But it means referral decisions are often made on the basis of vague familiarity rather than specific knowledge of what OT can offer.
What would a better referral pathway look like? If Daniel's listening and thinking, this sounds relevant to me or someone I know, what should the system be doing?
A few things. First, primary care should have OT screening built into standard care pathways for certain presentations. If someone comes in with chronic fatigue, sensory sensitivities, executive function complaints, or difficulty managing daily activities due to any condition, an OT assessment should be as routine as a blood test. Second, we need direct access. In many places, you need a doctor's referral to see an OT, which creates a bottleneck. In some jurisdictions, OTs are moving toward direct access models where you can self-refer.
That makes sense. If I know I'm struggling with daily functioning, why do I need a gatekeeper to confirm that before I can see the professional who specializes in exactly that?
The counterargument is that you want to rule out underlying medical causes first. You don't want someone with a brain tumor getting sensory integration therapy. But a competent OT is trained to recognize red flags and refer back to a physician when something doesn't fit. That's standard practice.
Let's talk about the evidence base, because I think there's a perception that OT is kind of soft, nice, but not rigorously proven.
The evidence base is actually substantial, but it's uneven across practice areas. Stroke rehabilitation, OT, has very strong evidence. Multiple systematic reviews and randomized controlled trials showing that OT improves functional outcomes and reduces institutionalization. Pediatric sensory integration has a growing evidence base, though it's been controversial. The current consensus is that it can help with sensory processing challenges specifically, but the evidence for broader developmental effects is mixed. The adult sensory processing work, misophonia, hyperacusis, is an emerging area largely from case series and small controlled studies at this point. But the theoretical framework is grounded in well-established neuroscience about sensory gating and autonomic arousal. And anecdotally, the outcomes can be transformative. I've read case reports of people who couldn't eat with their families because of misophonia, and after OT intervention, they could participate in family meals again.
That's a quality of life outcome that's hard to capture in a standardized scale, but life-changing.
That's actually one of OT's strengths. The profession has always prioritized participation and quality of life as outcomes, not just symptom reduction. The Canadian Model of Occupational Performance, one of the major theoretical frameworks in the field, explicitly centers spirituality and meaning, not in a religious sense, but in the sense of what gives a person's life purpose and coherence.
CMOP. So the OT is trained to ask not just what can't you do, but what matters to you that you can't do.
And that's what distinguishes it from a purely biomedical approach. A surgeon fixes your knee so the joint works. An OT asks what you need that knee to do. Kneel in the garden, climb stairs to your apartment, get down on the floor with your grandchildren, and then make sure the rehabilitation targets those specific activities.
I want to push on something. You said earlier that OT emerged from the mental hygiene movement and the World War I experience. How has the profession evolved since then? Because the scope you're describing now seems much broader than what I'd imagine from those origins.
The profession has undergone several major paradigm shifts. In the early days, it was very much about crafts and activities as therapy, basket weaving, woodworking, that kind of thing. By the 1960s and 70s, there was a move toward a more scientific, theory-driven approach. That's when Ayres developed sensory integration theory, and when the profession started developing standardized assessments. The big shift in the last 20 years has been toward occupation-based practice. The idea that therapy should happen in the context of real activities, not just exercise drills. So instead of having someone do arm exercises with weights, you have them actually make a sandwich or fold laundry, because the neural patterns and motivation are different when the activity is meaningful.
That makes intuitive sense. The brain engages differently when there's a purpose.
There's good neuroscience behind it. Meaningful activities activate reward circuits that enhance motor learning and neuroplasticity. If you're just doing repetitions, you get repetition-based learning. If you're doing something that matters to you, you get reward-enhanced learning.
Let's bring this back to the adult who's listening and thinking, maybe this applies to me. What are the signs that someone should consider an OT assessment?
I'd say there are several clusters. One is sensory, if you're persistently bothered by sounds, lights, textures, or crowded environments in ways that limit your participation in activities you care about. Two is executive function, if you struggle with planning, initiating tasks, managing time, or organizing your environment despite wanting to and trying to. Three is energy, if you have a chronic condition and you're constantly crashing because you can't figure out how to pace yourself effectively. Four is life transitions. After a divorce, a new diagnosis, a move, having a child, any major transition can disrupt your occupational patterns, and an OT can help you rebuild them.
What about the assistive technology angle for someone who doesn't have an obvious disability? Is there a role for OT in just optimizing how someone functions?
And this is where the profession is expanding into new territory. Ergonomic assessments for remote workers, cognitive strategy coaching for knowledge workers, environmental design consultation. The line between clinical intervention and performance optimization gets blurry, but the OT skill set applies to both.
That actually connects to something in the news recently. Google's Gemini AI assistant is now being integrated into millions of vehicles, and the U.S. government and allies just published guidance on safely deploying AI as AI becomes embedded in everyday environments. The person environment fit question gets more complex. An OT in 20 years might be helping people manage their relationship with AI agents the way they currently help with sensory environments.
That's a fascinating extension. If your smart home is making decisions that affect your daily routine and you're finding it dysregulating rather than helpful, who helps you reconfigure that relationship? That's an occupational performance issue. I could see OT developing a whole subspecialty in human-AI interaction design from the user's perspective.
All right, let's land the referral pathway question more concretely. If someone listening thinks they'd benefit from OT, what do they actually do on Monday morning?
It depends on where they are. In the U.S., you can find OTs through your insurance provider directory, though coverage for adult sensory or mental health OT is inconsistent. Private pay is common. Professional organizations like the American Occupational Therapy Association have Find a Therapist tools. In the UK, OTs are available through the NHS, though waiting lists can be long and you typically need a GP referral. In Israel, where Daniel is, OTs are in the public health system through the Kupot, but adult OT for sensory or executive function issues is less established than pediatric or physical rehab. Private practice is probably the most reliable route.
The referral pathway problem isn't just about awareness. It's about systemic availability. Even when people know what OT can do, the services might not be funded or accessible.
That's the structural barrier, and it creates an equity problem, because the people who can afford private OT get access to this incredibly helpful support, and everyone else just struggles.
Which is a familiar pattern across healthcare, but somehow more frustrating when the intervention is relatively low cost and non-invasive.
We're not talking about a $100,000 drug. We're talking about someone coming to your home, analyzing your kitchen setup, and teaching you energy conservation techniques. The cost effectiveness is potentially enormous, but the funding models aren't designed for it.
I want to touch on one more thing before we wrap. The training pathway. You mentioned it's a master's or doctorate now. What does that curriculum actually cover?
It's surprisingly biomedical. Anatomy with cadaver dissection, neuroscience, kinesiology, pathology, research methods. Then the OT-specific content, occupational theory, activity analysis, assessment and intervention across the lifespan, fieldwork placements in multiple settings. In the U.S., the entry-level doctorate, the OTD, now includes coursework in program evaluation, leadership, and advanced clinical reasoning.
These are not people who took a weekend certification course. They're doctoral-level clinicians.
Yet the public perception lags far behind the training reality. Part of that is that OTs don't wear white coats or carry stethoscopes. The visual cues of medical authority aren't there, and the work itself looks deceptively simple. When an OT is helping someone organize their closet, it looks like they're just helping someone organize their closet. The neuroscience and activity analysis behind it are invisible.
That's the curse of making complex things look easy.
It really is.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The national animal of Scotland is the unicorn.
Right. Here's the forward-looking thought I want to leave listeners with. As the population ages and chronic conditions become more prevalent, the kind of functional, context-sensitive support that OT provides is going to become more necessary, not less. The question is whether the profession can make itself legible enough to the public, to funders, to referring physicians, that the people who need it can actually find it.
I think the other question is whether healthcare systems can shift from a purely biomedical model to one that takes occupational participation seriously as a health outcome. Because right now, if your blood work looks fine and your imaging is clear, the system often tells you you're healthy, even if you can't manage your daily life.
That's the gap OT fills, and most people don't know it exists. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at My Weird Prompts.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.